This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Sunday, Iraqis can vote in that country's first democratic election since the 1950s. No one knows how many people will turn out, nor is there any way to know how many of those people who don't vote make that decision out of fear or apathy or because they support calls for a boycott. President Bush and other administration officials don't respond when asked to specify how many voters it will take to add up to success on Sunday. Yesterday, the president said the fact that there's a vote at all is extraordinary. While no one believes that the election by itself will mean dramatic change, a credible vote would lend a new Iraqi government legitimacy and help to engage the Iraqi people in a political process that could gradually undermine support for the insurgency. Sunday's election is unusual, but not unique. Elections have been held in other countries unaccustomed to democracy, some under occupation, and still others in the middle of armed conflict. Sometimes those elections have led towards democracy, sometimes they haven't. Later in the program, we have an email challenge for you. A week ago today, President Bush declared his goal to end tyranny around the world. The following day, administration officials clarified that ringing statement, saying that an end to tyranny was an ideal and does not change policy toward any country in particular. What about other famous speeches, wrote Hannah Rosen of the Washington Post? Patrick Henry, for example, liberty or death were just two of the choices I happen to mention, but of course there are others. Figure out how famous figures, real or fictional, might have backtracked, Winston Churchill or Scarlett O'Hara or Julius Caesar. I didn't mean to single out my good friend Brutus. Send us an email with backtrack in the subject line. The address is TOTN at NPR.org. Again, that's TOTN at NPR.org. First, though, the complex relationship between elections and democracy. What does history tell us? What makes some of them work and others fail? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is TOTN at NPR.org. We begin with Samuel Issacharoff, a law professor at Columbia University, a visiting professor at New York University's Law School. He joins us from his office at NYU. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And let's begin. Give us an example, if you would, where elections worked, places where elections did lead to democracy, and maybe one where it didn't necessarily.
Well, elections have led to democracy in terrible circumstances, such as post-war Japan, in admirable circumstances, such as the negotiated accords to end apartheid in South Africa. And we have many, many examples where, unfortunately, elections occurred once, and after that, the victors used the electoral coalition to and the power of the state to snuff out the minority. The losers, examples include Zimbabwe now, it includes the Central African Republic, it includes, unfortunately, many of the former Soviet republics of the Central Asian area.
And is there anything that gives you ideas about why some work and why others don't?
Well, there are two things that people point to retrospectively. One is there a cultural and economic basis in the society? There's a lot of studies that indicate that with a per capita income of less than basically $3,000, there are virtually no democracies that take hold. That portends poorly, for example, for Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. The other is you need some sort of agreement among the respected elites of the various sectors of the society that they are going to throw themselves into the political process and hold themselves accountable to the political process. And that, unfortunately, you can only tell retrospectively. They will all talk the electoral game the first time. The question is, the second time, will they put themselves up for office? Can they be voted out of office? And is there still a freely organized minority and a dissent by the time of the second election?
And that's why, for example, using our own history, you cite perhaps the most important election of them all as the election of 1800.
In retrospect, for Americans, we think, we always have elections, and every 4 years the governor leave and new people come in, and that's just the way it is. In 1800, you had this dramatic election where the Federalists and Anti-Federalists were going head-to-head, where the Federalists accused the Jeffersonians of being agents of France, where the Jeffersonians accused the Federalists of being agents of Britain. And there had never been the experience where the highest official of a country got voted out of office and his rival got voted in. Once that happened in 1800, it more or less was clear that that was going to take hold across American history.
And that election, we should remember, looking back no further than November, that election was really bitter and really partisan.
And about real issues. And, we think back on Florida 2000 and think that was a very bitter election. But actually, the candidates at the time seemed fairly comparable. The disputed issues were prescription drugs and things of that sort. 1800 was about whether this country would exist, whether we were chock-a-block with agents of foreign powers taking over the halls of government in Washington. It was unlike anything we've had before or since.
As we look toward the election in Iraq, an example many people cite is Algeria. Tell us about that.
Well, Algeria is a problem that many countries face, which is that you have a clear anti-democratic religiously inflamed group that uses the semblance of democracy to take power and clearly intends to impose a new religious order. Algeria also has the fact that it has a ruling caste which has no democratic legitimacy, but which holds on by portraying to many other parts of the world the fear that popular democracy means religious intolerance. And this is a paradox that we see in many countries. It's one of the reasons that it's so important to focus on the role of the Ayatollah al-Sistani in Iraq.
The most respected of the Shia clergy.
Absolutely. The dominant figure in the over the last year in Iraqi politics. And at each turn thus far, the Ayatollah al-Sistani has insisted upon greater democratic accountability. He agreed to the terms of the interim constitution, which restrict the powers of the majority. He agreed to an interim constitution which guarantees women 25% of the seats in the parliament, something that in the National Assembly, something that is not at all a given in an Islamic country. And he has not tried to use the ability to mobilize the Shiite majority in conditions of tremendous uncertainty as an attempt to impose theocratic rule, at least not thus far. This is probably the single most positive development that the United States has encountered in Iraq.
We're talking about the relationship between elections and democracy. Our guest is Samuel Issacharoff, a law professor at Columbia University. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Matthew. Matthew's calling from Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Yes, hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I'll go ahead and tell you that I have been exhaustively challenged with the same. It's getting to be pretty much a cliche conversation that whenever people ask me why I don't vote, I don't cite ignorance or apathy, but I cite, deliberate non-participation. And oftentimes, I will register wherever I'm supposed to register, and I will not vote because I don't see a candidate that represents my interests, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to choose between two evils. And I think that there's a, really popular tendency to overlook how strong that sentiment has become, especially, I suppose, in my generation. But I wanted to ask you do people consider it realistic to have alternative, mechanisms than, the one vote, per voter, et cetera? I mean, are there any, other, nuanced alternatives?
You want the none of the above?
Well, I mean, short of having to abstain and say, I want my vote to represent my, lack of faith in both parties, both candidates, I mean, it just seems like such a limited type of political agency that it really affects my ability to have faith in the system, and I know that I'm certainly not unique in that sentiment.
Well, in Iraq, you have well over 100 different political parties representing just about every point on the ideological spectrum. So I think that people who don't vote in Iraq are not doing so because they can't find a candidate that they find aligned with them, I think.
But the objection, I think, is relevant on both ends of the extreme. I mean, if you have only, you know, two options to vote for and neither of them represent your interests, that's a problem. But also, I suppose that, I mean, if there's 100 different parties and it being the first election, you know, there's a lot of people out there who don't think that, you know, there's a particular party expected to win, a particular party expected to be the runner-up.
There's any sense of who is going to win what exactly there, because there's been no precedent for it. But I would take issue with your premise. I think that it is a comfortable position to take in a relatively stable, tolerant society that one doesn't want to stake oneself on the acts of citizenship like voting, knowing full well that our lives are going to go on pretty much as they have before, and perhaps suspecting that the outcome of the election is not going to make much difference in our lives. I think the outcome of Sunday could potentially make a huge difference in the lives of Iraqis. I think that this is the first time that they have had a chance in two generations to participate in an election that actually could have an impact. That is, they are selecting the people who will write the Constitution for the country. They are selecting the first group of civilian legislators who are not beholden to the monarchy or to the military of Iraq. Whether they can constitute a government, whether they can have a stable society, whether they can reimpose social order so that people can go out in the street, the stakes are so dramatic that I think that to generalize from disaffection that people have for how little is at stake in American elections is a luxury that's not warranted.
Matthew, thanks for the call.
Hey, have a good one.
And we'll have more of your calls and emails after we come back from a short break. We're talking about elections and democracy. We'll be joined by an expert who's monitored elections in more than 25 countries. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A reminder, we have an email challenge working for a bit later in the program. Last week, President Bush called for an end to tyranny in his inaugural address. The statement was later softened by administration officials who said that was indeed a goal, but not something that transforms into policy straight away. We'd like you to imagine how famous historical, political, or fictional figures might have issued post hoc judgments upon delivering their memorable lines. Think Hamlet or Marie Antoinette, Franklin Delano Roosevelt or Ronald Reagan. Send us an email with backtrack in the subject line. The address is TOTN at NPR.org. Again, TOTN at NPR.org. Right now we're talking about the political process that gets a country to democracy. What part do elections play in it? Still with us is Samuel Zakharoff, a Columbia University law professor and an expert on the political process, and he's with us on the line from New York. Joining us in Studio 3A is Erik Bjornlund, a principal of Democracy International and author of Beyond Free and Fair, Monitoring Elections and Building Democracy. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me.
Do elections in and of themselves encourage participation in the political process?
I think they certainly can. That is one of the several benefits that elections can have, particularly in transitional or post-conflict environments. One of the significant benefits of holding elections is it can change the way people view political power, and it can get people involved in the political process in a way they weren't previously.
Do elections in and of themselves guarantee a political process?
Well, of course not. Many people have commented that the international community has overemphasized elections in transitional environments, and the international community has played a larger and larger role over the last 10 or 15 years in building transitions to democracy. And it is certainly true that elections can exacerbate social divisions and can give an opportunity for demagogues to play up ethnic differences and encourage those kinds of unfortunate divisions. But elections certainly have the potential to reinforce norms of human rights and set new precedents for freedom of expression and association and In many situations, elections have been a very positive development.
Mm-hmm. Why in various places, and again, Iraq is, of course, a unique situation, but there have been, maybe not so unique, there have been other situations like it. And people talk about, well, why are they rushing into an election so far, so quickly?
Well, I think certainly there's a legitimate and reasonable concern on the part of Iraqi authorities and the United States government and the international community about the legitimacy of the government in Iraq. So an election has at least the potential of providing legitimacy to what comes after it. And in this case, electing an assembly that can write a constitution, if that assembly has the support of the public, if there's participation in the election process, that assembly has the potential to have legitimacy and to develop a constitution that has broader support and really to be a significant step towards democracy. Mm-hmm. It has the potential to do that. Of course, there's very high risks in this election.
Sure. Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Dave, who's with us from Sevastopol, California.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I have been curious about what the effect is on the elections in Iraq of the underlying tribalism in Iraq, and if the fact that basically the Sunnis were the ruling class for so many years under Saddam and represent sort of a tribal minority, and to a certain extent have withdrawn themselves from this election, if that doesn't just invalidate the outcome of the election right from the get-go, if it isn't, you know, just sort of an artificially imposed sort of almost ceremonial thing that really doesn't have any meaning in terms of the underlying, you know, sociological forces going on in Iraq.
Well, Dave, let's begin with the premise that no matter what happens in Iraq, somebody will say it's legitimate and somebody else will say it's illegitimate. But let's get an answer to those questions from both of our guests. Eric Bjornlund, why don't we begin with you?
Well, obviously, it matters a lot that there's participation across the society, and it'll be a significant problem for the legitimacy of the process if a significant minority does not participate in significant numbers at all. There is, of course, great fear that the Sunni population will not participate. And this is exacerbated in Iraq by the election system because it's a one national election. It's one national list for a constituent assembly. So if Sunni Iraqis don't participate in significant numbers, presumably Sunni will not be represented in significant numbers in the assembly. That's certainly a problem. There will be other opportunities, one hopes, after the election to involve Sunni politicians and the Sunni community in the political process, and this will not be the election in Iraq even this year. Mm-hmm. So we hope that that's not the final outcome.
Samuel Zakharov, there have to be earlier situations or other countries in which one minority or another felt excluded from the election.
Even in South Africa, the Zulu leadership walked out on the negotiations. This is not fatal. It happens. You can't let any minority have a veto power. I think it's inescapable on Sunday that there will be virtually no voting in the Sunni areas of the country. The security situation is disastrous. The Sunni leadership, even if they wanted to participate in the elections, would look foolish because their supporters could not turn out. So they have had no choice but to call for a boycott, just recognizing the facts on the ground. But I don't think that's the end of the story, as Eric was getting at a second ago. What we have is the beginning of a constitutional process, and the Sunni leaders who are able to speak publicly have already said that even though they're boycotting the election, they want to be part of the next phase of the constitutional negotiations and presumably of the elections in December for the formal assembly once the new constitution is ratified. And one of the big tests for a new democracy is whether the largest bloc, the majority, will accept constraints upon its rule. Will this be a Shiite command and control society, or will there be real pluralism there? We have one piece that's very important here, which is that the Kurds are participating, and they're participating actively. They've made the demands for federalism and for all sorts of guarantees, part of the interim constitution and part of the negotiations going forward. So even though the Sunnis are not directly participating at this point, they will participate in the next stage. Interests of minorities are being Kurds. Ironically, the Kurds are now protecting the interests of the Sunnis, who were their oppressors during the Saddam period. And it's a very fluid, very volatile situation that we shouldn't be too quick to write off just because we were unable to bring security to the Sunni areas.
Dave, thanks for the question. Here's an email we got from Pradeep Nambiar. What does your guest think about the Pakistani experience, half the time experience and the rest of the time military rule? And again, you'd have to say that Pakistan is not the only example of that in the world either. Sam?
Well, you know, there are, unfortunately, Pakistan is more typical than not. The exceptional country really is India, which, despite this terrible ethnic division, has more or less imperfectly held together more or less a democracy for the last 60 years, even though it was born of massive communal warfare and communal strife and even slaughter. Pakistan is the society that has been unable to stabilize civilian rule, civilian institutions. In some sense, Iraq is a more hopeful case than Pakistan because it is a society with more internal resources, a more educated population, until the last 20 years, a higher standard of living, higher literacy, higher development of political parties and of independent civic organizations. So Pakistan is unfortunately what most of the world has seen, but there are counterexamples.
Eric Bjornlund, I wanted to ask you, the business of election monitoring and democracy building has become indeed a business. You're credited as among the founders of that business.
Well, I always like to point out to people that 20 years ago, election observation meant a couple of human rights lawyers getting off a plane in Central America or what's now Zimbabwe the day before the election and going around and asking a few questions and offering their comments to journalists. International election observation now is one part of an even larger democracy promotion industry that started really as an NGO activity in the United States and in Europe and has now become fully institutionalized at international organizations. So you have huge efforts at the United Nations, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the Organization of American States, the European Union, big bureaucracies to promote democracy in general, and one of the flagship activities is observing elections.
And that obviously played a huge role in, for example, the election in Ukraine.
It played a very large role in Ukraine. There was a very, very large number of international observers. I think it was as large as any country since South Africa 10 years earlier. And international observers together with domestic counterparts. And one of the things we should all remember is that in civil society groups in their own countries have played very significant roles in bringing about democratic elections in many transitional environments. But in Ukraine, those domestic monitors and international observers really convinced the international community that there were serious problems with the elections that took place this fall, especially in the second round in November 21st. And that that consensus led to significant international support for addressing those problems and for the domestic opposition movement that came out and asked for new elections.
Here's an email we have from Eugene Liu, who describes himself as a first-year medical student at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland. As a Peace Corps volunteer in Turkmenistan, a former Soviet republic, I witnessed firsthand living under the rule of one person, the president of Turkmenistan, who sees himself as the father of the modern state and thus justifies his dictatorship as necessary to ensure the stability of the state. He argues that with this stability, a truly democratic system can then arise and points to Turkey as an example of this eventual democratization. Having had this experience, I wonder, is stability requisite to true democracy, and what does history have to say about the Turkmen president? Claim. Did you want to comment on that, Samuel Isarikov?
Well, yes. You don't get real democracies without social stability, you don't get them for very long, like Weimar, Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, you don't very often get real social stability and political equality from strongman rule. And every tyrant claims to be ruling in the name of the people. Every tyranny of the 20th century adopted the name of the people's this or the democratic republic of that. And, unfortunately, we can all claim to be whatever we want. But if the question is together one-man, strong-armed rule with military suppression is a harbinger of democracy, history tells us that's a pretty bad path to go down.
Samuel Zakharov, thank you very much for being with us today. Samuel Zakharov is a law professor at Columbia University and New York University, and he joined us from his office at NYU. We're discussing the relationship between elections and democracy. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And joining us now to talk about some of the special circumstances surrounding the elections in time of conflict is Thomas Carruthers, Director of Democracy and of the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's with us from the Brookings Institution. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon.
How does unrest or conflict, and certainly we have that in Iraq, how does that make elections, especially first elections, different from, well, elections that are being held in peaceful situations?
Well, it makes them a lot harder. We have to understand that what's happening or is going to happen this weekend in Iraq is quite unusual. The normal pattern when you have civil conflict or other kind of military conflict is first you solve the conflict, then you have the elections. And the elections are kind of the kiss of approval on the peace process that's gone on. Here we're having elections when an insurgency is still going on. And so it's a lot more difficult and, as a result, a lot riskier for the country and for the people of Iraq because, as you've been reading about in the paper, we've all been reading about, normal, everyday Iraqis are going to have to take tremendous risks just to vote. And this is actually quite unusual. We've certainly had conflict in elections before. In Chechnya, for example, Chechens have had to go out and vote, or at least if they'd wanted to go out and vote in times of conflict in recent years, in Colombia and El Salvador in the 1980s. But this level of violence in this important of an election is quite unusual.
And what tends to be the outcome when people vote in violent situations?
Well, of course, lower turnout, obviously. And then that leads, as Eric was talking about, to boycott of some of the parties because they realize they're not going to do well, so they pull out, so decreasing legitimacy. And those are the big structural issues that are really a question here, is what kind of turnout will we have? What kind of legitimacy will the National Assembly that comes out of this have?
Does the mere fact of holding an election, does that tend to subdue or inflame unrest?
Well, it's hard to generalize, but we have to realize that holding an election is not the way civil conflict usually ends. Civil conflict usually ends for one of two reasons. The people who are fighting get beaten and crushed, or the two sides fight to a standstill and realize they're going to have to make peace with each other. Elections don't really serve either of those two functions. So in El Salvador, for example, you could have elections in 1982, then again in 84. There wasn't a peace agreement until 1991-92. Colombia has been in civil war for almost for decades. They've been having elections regularly. As I say, Chechnya has had elections, still have a war there. So elections can be part of a civil war and just be one more step, in a sense, in the conflict. And so there's no guarantee that even if you have successful elections, that that's going to be part of a peace-building process. This election is really about, can we start a political process in Iraq finally, 22 months after the U.S. invasion, of allowing Iraqis to create their own government and really get a political process going? In a sense, the question is, can we get to square one? We're not even at square one in the political process until we have these elections.
Let's get another caller on the line. And David is with us from San Francisco.
Hi, yeah, thanks, Neil.
Sure.
And guests, great show. It seems to me we could draw a lesson from South Africa, where there were the same kind of deep divisions, both ideological and with the same life and death consequences. And, you know, as part of the political process, in addition to elections, they had the Truth Commission, which I think was such an important leveling mechanism.
Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Exactly.
Eric Bjornlund, obviously South Africa was not in anywhere close to the same kind of strife that Iraq is.
Well, certainly the elections didn't take place in the same circumstances, although there was a lot of violence in the lead-up to the South African elections, and there was great concern about the safety of participants in the process and of voters. But the situation in Iraq is of a magnitude that makes it so different from anything that has come before it. And there won't even be international observers in Iraq, which really makes the election unusual in the last 10, 15 years.
But what about, briefly, David's point of there are other things that have to be going on in South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Well, of course. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has been widely studied and copied around the world because it was such a successful reconciliation process. I think it's a bigger topic than we can take on here, but I think most of that took place after the elections, if I recall correctly. So the elections were still you know, they were a step in the process. The truth and reconciliation process was something else. No one's saying that in any transitional environment mm-hmm. that elections can solve the conflict and be the only step that needs to be taken in order to have stable democratic institutions.
David, good point. Thanks for the call.
Thanks, Neil.
And Eric Bjornlund, we wanted to thank you for joining us today here in Studio 3A. Eric Bjornlund is the author of Beyond Free and Fair, Monitoring Elections and Building Democracy, and was kind enough to join us here in the studio. We'll continue this conversation after a short break, and don't forget the email challenge, to be or not to be. Sleep was an option, hey? I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about elections in a time of conflict, elections and democracy. Our guest is Thomas Carruthers, director of the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Houston. Houston's calling from Oklahoma City.
Yeah. I have, you know, I'm speaking from the point of view of being a soldier. We say that this is free election and free this, free on so on and so forth. If it's supposed to be free, if it's supposed to be open, why is it that we have soldiers, we have police, we have armor? Isn't their presence just taming the freedom of it? Or isn't it kind of like an oxymoron, a free election, but yet you have military, whatever, whatever?
Occupation, I think, is the term most people would use. Thomas Carruthers?
Yeah, I mean, you say free election.
Yeah.
Okay, that's like saying...
Well, let's get a response from the guest, Thomas.
Well, two things. First, you know, given the security situation, we need security forces to protect the election. This is a free society, but there are police in every city, and we regard them as necessary for our protection. Good, but that's a good point, which is the second is, are these security forces intimidating the population or in some way distorting it? I mean, the American forces are trying very hard not to be very present on Election Day, to be reaction forces to help out the security forces. I think that's the right decision, because there's the real sense that we do not want this to be a seen by Iraqi people as a colonial-style election with a colonial administrator standing there, although everyone knows there are 150,000 Americans there. They're protecting the security of the country. But you're right. There's a real problem here is that the elections are dependent upon the American forces, and that's precisely why the insurgents are saying this is all about the elections, because the elections are illegitimate because they're being stage-managed by the Americans. So legitimacy of the electoral process is at issue in Iraq because of the nature of the security situation.
Are there situations in other countries where votes have gone ahead under situations of occupation and succeeded?
Well, I mean, in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a number of cases where the United Nations with multinational forces are there and oversee the election in Cambodia, in Bosnia, in Mozambique. And these have been quite successful in some cases. But that's different because it comes under the UN imprimatur. You have multinational forces and you don't really have an ongoing civil conflict. The conflict is over. The international forces are really there just to guarantee the peace.
Mm-hmm. Houston, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's get another caller in, and this is Matt. Matt's calling from Virginia Beach.
Hello, Neil. How are you doing?
Okay.
Enjoy the show. Try to get to it every day if I can.
Well, thank you.
One question I would have for both of your guests, and I'll hang up and let you answer. But there's a dynamic, I guess. Any government, any form of government, can be good depending on the people that are administering it. I think it's a common theme. What is it, though, that is leading the thought process to think that the election in a democratic style of government is going to be the panacea of sorts for a region, for a country in a region that a democracy is such a foreign concept, simply because, historically speaking, you know, the Arab world is traditionally ruled by a much different form of government?
Well, the key here really is accountability, trying to establish the principle that the government of Iraq is accountable to the Iraqi people, and the Iraqi people chose it, and the government is of, by, and for the Iraqi people. So it's really accountability. It isn't really such an abstract Western philosophical concept. It's something that I think people all over the world will respond to, the idea that this is my government, it answers to me, and it can't just do whatever it wants. So that's really the core of what we're trying to establish through an electoral process like this.
And isn't every government has to establish legitimacy of some sort or another? There are, for example, elections in Egypt. They're nobody's idea of fair elections, but that presumably is how the government in Egypt derives its legitimacy. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. The what's driving this question is a democratic government, as you said, the legitimacy of the government and mm-hmm. the stakeholder sense that, you know, the constituents have. We view that as being, you know, we view an election as being requisite for that. You have to have an election to say to in order to feel like you have a stake in it. Whereas the culture of the Middle East, you know, dating far back before the formation of this country
mm-hmm.
and up to the present day, there's a sense of there's not that same sense of requiring an election. And so my question would be, why is it that we feel that an election and a free election or democracy would provide that sense of being a stakeholder to a people that aren't even used to thinking in terms of that?
That's a really good question. I mean, you're right. Some Arab governments are monarchies, and they rest upon familial rule, which has been passed down through, you know, in hereditary lines, and therefore the legitimacy is derived in very what we would consider old-fashioned ways. But it's interesting that Neil mentioned Egypt. Here's a government that a leader, Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, who really gets his legitimacy not from the elections because he doesn't put himself up for direct presidential election. Essentially, the elections in Egypt are referenda on the president in which there's no opposed candidate.
Right, but at least is it a form of the election?
Yeah, but it isn't really through the elections that the Egyptian government gets its legitimacy. If anything, it seems nervous about putting itself up to the vote of the people, because in republics in the Arab world, not monarchies, really the legitimacy does have to spring out of the consent of the people, and you have to begin to ask in countries like Egypt, why do they have to have such strong state security forces? Why don't they try a direct election? Maybe the majority of people in the country are not too happy with the government. Maybe it doesn't have too much legitimacy. So I think we ought to be careful about saying just because they have a tradition of strong man rule means the people prefer it that way. What it means is you have strongman rule, which prevents the people from speaking out and saying, hey, we'd like a government that is more accountable, more effective, and so forth.
Do you see places in the Middle East, and we're hearing about low-level elections in Jordan, even Saudi Arabia under some circumstances, do you see any indications that democracy, at least on some levels, is beginning to take hold?
Well, there's a lot of debate in Arab societies now about the need for better governance, about even the need for democracy in some cases, but you have tremendous resistance by the entrenched power class. And so you have some liberal intellectuals calling out for it. You have a lot of dissatisfied people at the you know, middle level of the society, but you don't really yet have broad pro-democratic movements. You have a lot of dissatisfaction. You have a lot of discussion. You have limited reforms by the government. We'll let you have a municipal election here. We'll try modifying that law here, but not really willing to take chances and put their rule up for grabs. So you do not yet have a democratic trend in the Middle East. Yet, I think experience has shown in regions all the way from Macedonia to Mongolia that if people are given the chance to take control of their own political fortune as a society, they would like to do so. And that's why you see people going out to vote in very difficult circumstances. Doesn't mean democracy is easy or automatic, but the human instinct to take control of your own life, not to be told what to do, not to be beaten on the head by secret police, is pretty strong.
Thomas Carruthers, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thomas Carruthers is the author of Uncharted Journey, Promoting Democracy in the Middle East, and he joined us from the Brookings Institution, which is here in Washington, D.C.